Welcome to the GuffMan. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Before we get started, check out our website, themcguffman.com. We mostly recently talked about The Revenant, and before that was The Hateful Eight and Star Wars The Force Awakens. I also wrote something that came out last week about Joy Carol Self-Image, the James Dean sort of biopic that came out last year, and Why I Don't Wear Sweatpants Outside of the House. So, yeah, you can check that out at themcguffman.com. Also, follow us on Twitter, at themcguffman, and tell all of your many friends about us. And, yeah, let's get started.
Welcome to The MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
Where do we start?
Well, we'll start by telling everyone that this is the Making a Murderer episode.
Yeah.
A very, very hot topic right now.
Yeah. Well, that's my main concern with when we're doing this podcast is that we might have missed the wave slightly. Yeah, just because I took my sweet time getting around to watching it, basically.
But. Yeah. And did you binge watch it or did you...
I actually don't think I watched two episodes consecutively at one point, and every other episode I watched was like a day apart from every other one.
Okay. And was that...
It was not conscious. I was just busy.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I was actually, the night I went over to a friend's to watch football playoffs, the Cardinals Green Bay game, I had just watched an episode of Making a Murderer, and I was telling my friend Cam that, you know, I just finished episode 5. And he's like, why are you here? Like, how are you? And I'm like, I don't know, because I like my life more than I like Saturday nights and Netflix. I don't know. So, but yeah, it seems to be the way that people watch it. It sounded like you watched it very quickly.
The first time through, I watched it somewhat spaced out. I mean, not extremely, but then the other time, once you decided that you wanted to do a podcast on this, I rewatched it with admittedly not 100% focus.
Yeah.
But probably about 95% focus.
And that's good for you. That's high.
That's for you, that's the meanest thing you can say to someone. No, so I watched it pretty quickly. I mean, within 4 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, you feel a lot of people are doing it. I mean, watching 3-4 in a row. Is that what you're
guessing? Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, it's certainly everybody that I've talked to about it. I think my sister said she went through it really quickly, and I can't remember who else, but pretty much everybody that I know that has talked to me about it, and there have been many people, have mentioned how quickly they watched it.
Yeah,
it seems to be like part of the deal.
Yeah, it seems like a weekend is a good average for the amount of time people are consuming these 10 intense hours of footage.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think that's accurate.
Does that surprise you at all?
No, I think it's because, I mean, we talked about this on the Seinfeld podcast, and probably any other time Netflix has come up. The Netflix model is to end an episode in a way that both makes you want to watch the next episode, and they also thrust the next episode upon you way too quickly.
20 seconds?
Oh, it's not even 20. It's 15, man. It's the worst. I hate it. There's nothing I hate more than... I very rarely use Netflix because of this to watch movies, because like the second a movie ends, it doesn't even let you get through the director credit, you know, before it's like, watch something else. I'm like, no, I'm not done watching this. You know, I want to know who did the cinematography.
Yeah.
That drives me bananas. But that is also like, that's how they pick up their shows. Like House of Cards was built around that, and House of Cards was their first notable, like, big foray into
original programming.
Yeah, exactly. And a big part of that was that they wanted something that was just so propulsive and would move so quickly and make you want to watch the next thing as fast as possible. And David Fincher and the Bo Willimon and that team wanted to make something like that too. You know?
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, this show, it is a Netflix original, but this is 10 years in the making. This wasn't,
yeah, exactly.
As though this was something that was always destined to be on Netflix. It got turned down by, HBO and PBS to actually be aired there.
Yeah.
Do you think that they would have had a lot of input about designing these episodes to be, you know, bingey, kind of cliffhangery, easily bleeding into the next one?
I'm not sure. I really don't know, because I think, because I don't know what the design, when I think when they set out to make this in 2005, Moira Demos and Laura Ricciardi, I think what they were probably thinking of it as is like a movie. They weren't necessarily, I don't think it was ever planned to be 10 hours until much later in the process, right? And I think they kind of got lucky that Netflix became a thing. Yeah. And I think they're fully aware of that. I think they mentioned that on Colbert. I think that once it sort of became a miniseries, those cliffhangers would have been something that they added in anyway. But if they didn't, Netflix would have asked for it. I'm certain of it. But I do think that in the style of the show, it fits and was probably a part of their original idea as well.
Okay,
like,
yeah.
not original idea, but once it becomes an 8-part miniseries, which then expands to 10,
yeah.
Because they were signed for 8 initially and then turned it into 10. I think once they get to that point, they're adding the cliffhangers themselves.
Yeah. Any particular endings or cliffhangers you like?
I can't say I remember any off the top of my head.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've talked about how Netflix coming along kind of changed.
Is there anything for you?
I was going to talk about just the first episode because I think that's one of the really good ones.
Okay.
I also really enjoy.
Oh, is that the where they're like, do we have a body? Do we have a body?
Yeah, yet? We don't have a body, but we have Steve Avery in custody, though, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That one, which I think is good. And James Lang taking the stand because he's such a fantastic villain in this.
Oh yeah, for sure.
This story. But the first episode is released on YouTube concurrently with its release on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously everyone can watch it for free. And, you know, speaking about this kind of cliffhanger thing, I can imagine a lot of people watching the first episode mm-hmm. on YouTube and maybe not having that Netflix and kind of reconsidering that decision.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was a really smart choice. I mean, of all the shows to release the first episode of on YouTube, I think that this is... just by the nature of the story is such a great fit for that model.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. I mean, I certainly agree with that point. I was just trying to think of other Netflix shows where they could have done that as well. But I agree.
Okay.
And definitely with the cliffhanger aspect, it's really helpful.
Yeah. And you brought up the length of the show and being, expanded from 8 episodes to 10.
Yeah.
You'd ask me if I thought that this was too long mm-hmm. of a series.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it is. I mean, I could use more of it,
mm-hmm.
but I think that, you know, if the people who are taking this show very seriously, I mean, there are still ways to kind of live in this universe, you know,
we are currently,
no, but
yeah,
what I mean to look further into the case and to watch the interviews with, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting. I mean, True Detective's 8-hour long episodes too.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been the same. I don't know what the why that number seems to stick out. What do you think of the length of the series?
Well, I really like it because I also think that you know, people say, well, you could have cut it down. You could have made it 8 episodes or 6 or, you know, 10 shorter episodes. I think those are valid, but one of the things I like about how they made the show, the length of the show sort of feels like it feels long on purpose in the way that getting justice feels feels like a lengthy process. Like I like that they gave 2 full episodes to the trial, another one to Brendan Dassey's trial, and it's just I think that the show doesn't rush kind of makes it feel more I mean, realistic is a weird choice of word given that it's a documentary, but it makes it feel more like the experience of being in a courtroom because I worked in a courtroom for about 8 months at one point in my life on a murder trial. And it's not a very speedy process, you know, and that was one of the things that I really found interesting about the show was how long they took establishing things and how long they took sort of making sure you knew as much as they could, you know? And I really like that. I think it really helps the show.
Yeah, they said there's something like 250 hours of footage that they had to go through.
Yeah. Oh, there's just 240 hours of trial.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so we have courtroom footage.
And that doesn't, that wouldn't even count like the pre-trial motions where they talk about how much of the media they're going to allow into the courtroom and all that stuff, which is, in my experience, like takes up quite a bit of time as well.
Yeah. And I think absolutely what you said about kind of just the tedium and how you, you know, the slowness of it all, and how I think that contributes to the frustration of, you know, of Stephen Avery and Brandon Dassey and their families, and you know, of the Hallbacks and the victims' families. Of just kind of seeing how long this process takes, and
yeah, exactly.
There's just nothing you can do about it. And I think the length of it, and as you said, about giving you as much information as you can so you can kind of keep up. I mean, they were criticized for some things that they left out. Inevitably, things had to be left out. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to speak to the one-sidedness of it, but just a lot of people say what they like about it, and I think this goes hand in hand with people watching it in, you know, that binge manner, mm-hmm. is how immersive it is and how, you know, you really get to know these people, and you know, you spend time with Steven's family a lot, and you know, you just kind of get immersed in this world, and it's not that much different than, you know, our world. I mean, it's America, it's not that far, but yeah.
Wisconsin apparently seems to be like weirdo small town Canada. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I think it just kind of gives you do really kind of fall into that world, I think. And, you know, I think that's the length, that's the thoroughness, and, you know, the subject matter, and again, the binging of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what Winston Churchill said about speeches?
I do not.
Make them long enough to cover the important... speeches should be like a skirt.
Mm-hmm.
Long enough to cover the important bits, to short enough to keep you interested. and I mean, I think that applies to, you know, speeches and essays and documentaries, yeah. and things like that. And as I said, there's more... I mean, if you want to make it deeper... I mean, I could have used two more episodes because, mm-hmm. You know, I just find it that interesting, and... You know, some of that drier stuff I have, I think, less of a hard time with. But I think that if you do want to spend more time kind of in that world and looking at this, there's still ways to.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's called Reddit.
Yeah, apparently so.
Get into it. Which is not, in fairness, not something I really partake in. But, you know, it's easy to find ways to learn more about making a murderer and serial,
yeah,
and all
exactly.
these things.
And I'm someone who kind of is interested by conspiracy theories in general. And, you know, I look at the subreddit for this, and I don't need this. I don't need to be reading the days of trial that weren't included in the movie that badly.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And you had also asked me in an email something about this movie or this series compared to CSI, and, you yeah. know, not just this series in general, but kind of the true crime wave that we're into lately.
Yeah, for sure. Because I was just sort of thinking about, you know, again, like, I'll just give some quick background of when I actually did work in a courtroom. Like, I was the in-courtroom technician on a... murder trial. It's still Ontario's biggest mass murder, I believe. But it was, it's called the Shedden Massacre. There's a Wikipedia page on it. Six bikers killed eight other bikers just outside of London, Ontario. And those six, or maybe it was eight. Yeah, it was eight killing eight. One guy didn't end up getting prosecuted. The other guy turned and was like the witness, basically the star witness. In that courtroom, when I was working in that courtroom, it seemed like everybody was, like, all the lawyers and stuff that I was working with were very concerned with how the jury responds to evidence that's not scientific, because of how CSI had trained people to care so much about scientific evidence and less so about you know, more character type stuff, or cell phone data or stuff like that. And this is in 2009, so CSI is still a much more important thing. And that was very much how crime was depicted in popular media in the culture back then. And now it has totally shifted. It seems like the most popular crime stuff is stuff like Making a Murderer and specifically the first season of Serial, and the Jinx was the least popular of those three things, but still made waves, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I don't necessarily have a read as to why. It's just really interesting to me. You know?
Yeah. Well, a few things. That effect about the forensic evidence being used in courtrooms was something that was studied and written about. It was called the CSI effect. And
yeah.
lawyers talked about how they're having a hard time with cases that they would have had not that difficult of a time with 10 years ago, but because they don't have whatever it is that they were using on CSI, people don't feel as secure sending someone to jail without that kind of evidence. And I mean, that's just, you know, being exposed to a certain kind of justice on a fictional television show, skewing your opinion on how the real court system works. So you're not alone in experiencing that. And I think that was a very interesting example of art affecting, well, art, CSI, entertainment affecting the real world. And I thought that was kind of something very fascinating that I wouldn't have thought of.
But yeah.
You know, you saw it firsthand and other people did too.
Yeah. Well, and I think sometimes the, cause I mean, it's been so long since I've read about the OJ trial, but there was some DNA evidence introduced in that trial that it seemed like the people didn't respond to it as much just because DNA evidence was still, was not as well known as like a thing that you can trust. And anyway, I just, somebody brought that up recently and I thought that was kind of interesting, and it sort of shows a very specific moment in time how we settled on DNA evidence, and then 15 years later it was like all people cared about, you know.
Yeah. And I what you had asked me was something about the popularity of how CSI and you know, narrative cop shows like that, fictional ones, used to be so popular, and now it's you know, Serial and The Jinx and Making a Murderer. Do you think it's the same people who kind of jump ship from CSI onto these things?
Not necessarily. Because you and I weren't the type of people that were watching CSI.
Right. Yeah, and I think a lot of the people who I've had conversations about Making a Murderer with don't have a history with those kinds of shows. And I imagine there would be some overlap because people who are really interested in criminal justice and things like that would watch both. But to me, I just didn't feel like this group, this hypothetical group of viewers, jumped from that kind of show to these kinds of shows.
Yeah, there's certainly some overlap because my sister is the biggest CSI fan I know, and she definitely has watched Making a Murderer. So
yeah,
it's not like the two groups never cross over. But yeah, I think you're right in that it's not the same group of people, you know?
Yeah. But I think part of that might be that, you know, with narrow casting, with just there being more content out there, people can watch what they like. I mean, if you're interested, because just there's so many more things and you can spend more time in this kind of one little stream. And if you're into criminal justice, but you're not into, you know, the fictional kind, if you're not into again, not knowing much about CSI, I imagine there was still kind of those plot lines that weren't about the murder, but were about the people working at CSI and their relationships with each other and things like that. And I mean, that kind of stuff is just absent in these new kinds of true crime things that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So instead of watching that, instead of watching 10 hours of CSI, you can watch one episode or one season of Making a Murderer and still kind of get your fix in that way, but without having to spend any of your time on kind of this ancillary stuff that might not interest you as much.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's something interesting in this because it kind of touches on that divide within this series a few times. We have that interview with the Dateline female producer. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
Okay, so she's talking about following the Avery story and airing, you know, things bit by bit as they come up.
Yeah.
And, you know, she says murder's really hot right now. And there's, to
paraphrase. So hot right now.
Yeah. And I think that most of the viewers of Making a Murderer kind of felt that was really... maybe not immoral, but exploitative and like just kind of a cold way to talk about, you know, these victims. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a statement that's absolutely true right now. And I think that a lot of the viewers of Making a Murderer kind of looked at that woman as, you know, kind of cold, as I said. But I think she was right about that. And I think, you know, and that was years ago. And I think that it's true again, but just kind of in a different way. And I think that there's kind of this moral high ground people take about watching shows like this versus watching Nancy Grace or Dateline and, you know, that kind of programming. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know that there's that much of a difference. And I want your opinion on that.
I think, I mean, considering Making a Murderer or comparing Making a Murderer to Nancy Grace, I think there's a different level of thoughtfulness. And just because, you know, Ricciardi and Demos spent 10 years on Making a Murderer, whereas Nancy Grace spends a day on one of her shows. Just because that's not me saying she, you know, she's not a thoughtful person or anything. It's just me saying that that's how broadcast TV works. And she does a show a day. And, you know, they only have 8 hours to 8 to 10 hours to figure out what it's going to be. So there's definitely a different level of thoughtfulness and consideration that goes into them just through the nature of the medium. But they are both sort of tackling topics that or trying to tackle topics that a lot of people care about. You know, like Nancy Grace wants a lot of people to watch her show. Nancy Grace's producers want a lot of people to watch her show. Ricciardi and Demos do too, and so does Netflix, you know, and they've certainly succeeded. And they've sort of found a way. And they are talking about something that is a news story. Both Grace and Making a Murderer, but there's just a different way to how they talk about the news story. Even if in you get an hour of Nancy Grace and she talks to three people, you're still getting three, you know, three if you're lucky opinions if Nancy Grace doesn't drop all over them. But whereas there's a I know the level of objectivity in Making a Murderer has been questioned, and I think that's fair. But there's certainly more objectivity to Making a Murderer than there is to Nancy Grace.
Yeah and I
and most magazine shows, even ones that aren't hosted by crazy people.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you knew right away that I wasn't saying that they're the same thing, but I just wanted your opinion. I mean, I got that feeling too when Brandon gets convicted and we see his mom walk to the car and she's, you know, obviously going through a very emotional moment and yelling, and we kind of have all these cameras chasing her.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're just one more camera in that crowd.
Yeah,
know
no,
what
exactly.
I mean? You know, we're not yelling, it seems. We don't hear Laura and Maura's voice, I don't think, ever during the series.
No.
And I think that kind of adds to that level of intellectualness, objectivity, and just kind of a more journalistic approach than those programs. And I would say even more so than Jinx and Serial. Would you agree?
Certainly more than Serial. I can't speak to the Jinx. From what I know about the Jinx, which I have not watched, that is true.
Jarecki?
yeah, exactly. Spring and Nate, actually, right after they had watched it, they told me a lot about the show, and it sounded pretty funny. yeah. But certainly to Serial, because, I mean, Sarah Koenig is such a big part of the storytelling in Serial, to the point where I think it kind of hinders the show sometimes. But yes, definitely of those three shows, this is the one that, to my knowledge, is the most objective. And you talked about what is one of my favorite moments in the series, specifically because of what you're talking about. It's like, yeah, but, you know, we're watching this thing and we're witnessing this trial, but there's still very real ramifications that to what is happening here. And also there are ethics to certain things, and maybe you shouldn't follow her out of the courtroom today, you know? And
it's,
I understand
the juiciest bit, you know?
I know. I understand why everybody did it. but it's that type of stuff also just generally camera people not knowing when to turn the camera off just kind of upsets me in general. But I don't know. That one was a little I thought that was the hardest moment to watch in the series.
Yeah, and it's speaking of camera people not knowing, I mean, her husband there, you know, starts yelling at them and kind of pleads for a bit of, you know, respect. Mm-hmm. and you see them kind of turn around and lower their cameras and walk away. But then she starts yelling again. And then, you know, those people who I feel just kind of got admonished and felt bad are like, this is kind of too good. You know, I do see what he's saying and I do feel sympathy, but I'm going to get in trouble if someone else gets this footage and I don't, and they all just turn around and start filming again.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that fine line of, you know, how tasteful to be. And I think that's a question that I imagine Laura and Moira would have to ask themselves when compiling all this.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like immediately upon, you know, deciding that they're going to film this and then figuring out slowly as they start doing it, how they're actually going to do it, what their limits are going to be. And then, yes, also in editing as well.
Yeah. And I think another thing to go back to the kind of comparisons to those other programs that we're talking about, I'm going to throw another old timey quote at you. Eleanor Roosevelt this time said, "Great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, and small minds discuss people." And, you know, I think along that continuum, you can say that, you know, a more of a Nancy Grace approach is more about Stephen Avery and Brandon Dassey and, you know, maybe Teresa Hallback. But in interviews with Laura Moira and what I kind of pieced together, and I think a lot of people did just from watching what they had created, it's not necessarily about whether Stephen Avery did it or, you know, even just Stephen Avery. Mm-hmm. And when they get asked, "Do you think he did it?" They never say, "I think he's innocent," or "I think he's guilty," or "I think he did it," "I think he didn't." They say, "I think that the state failed to present a case that goes beyond reasonable doubt." And it's more about the justice system and maybe the treatment of poor people within that system and the way that they, the way that the system functions, less than what happened that night at the garage or wherever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just didn't know what you thought about their kind of caginess about stating their opinions about exactly what went down.
Oh yeah. No, I think it's great. It's
awesome, right?
Yeah. it's great that they never really choose a side. And one of the things that I like about the show, I like the title of the show, Making a Murderer, because it sort of implies that somewhere in this county a murderer was made, and the how is what they're really more interested in than the actual details, like, because that's why they go into his backstory so much, and especially with him being wrongfully convicted and in prison for 18 years, I think, before he gets released, and just sort of the, you know, something that's never mentioned or never stated explicitly, but just like, if he did commit this murder, maybe the state's failure led him to do it. And if he didn't commit the murder, the state's failure is certainly, certainly important here. And I thought that was really interesting. And I think it sort of really speaks to the overarching effect of the show, and also the more subtle aspects of the show that I like specifically that they never draw attention to the fact that that's what the title seems to be about. It's more about the justice system than specifically Stephen Avery. This is just a really good way to focus that idea, those ideas, you know?
Yeah. No, I love a good title and a good kind of thought-provoking one that can be interpreted a few ways. And yeah, I mean, did they make a murderer by framing him for the initial rape? Did they, you know, make a murderer by having Brandon Dassey kind of admit that he is one, even if that did or didn't take place? Or is it maybe the idea that Stephen Avery's time in jail kind of for a false conviction turned him into someone who is capable of committing the murder of Teresa Hallback? What else you got?
Well, I mean, we haven't talked about one of the things that's kind of fascinating to me about the way that this show has been accepted is the way people talk about Dean Strang weirds me out.
Yeah, I kind of didn't realize that all this discussion was taking place on the internet and in the world, because I like him. I think he's a pretty tough guy not to like.
Oh, for sure. And also,
Like, he seems like a likable person, but also anytime he talks about justice, it's like really arresting, you know, like it's just like he just really sort of grabs you with his opinions and his passion specifically.
But I find without overdoing it, like it's not too.
Yeah, exactly.
Rah, rah and soapboxy. Yeah. But it just seems like there is a genuine part of him that sees the flaws in this and cares greatly that they be fixed.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I just still haven't wrapped my head around it totally, I guess. And I'm just curious because, like, it's obviously interesting, you know, and as we said, his thoughts are likable and interesting. But the way people have sort of propped him up for the show, he seems kind of like he's the hero of the show, the way people have talked about him. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he's a defense attorney, and I find it hard to believe he, through his entire career, has represented exclusively innocent people, you know, and certainly seems like a good attorney, is propped up to be a very, very good attorney. So, like, he has probably freed somebody that's guilty, like, logically speaking, right? Thinking about it, right? And I'm just curious how that, or if that should come into people's minds when thinking about how enjoyable they find Dean Strang, if it matters, if it doesn't, because I do, you know, I view defense attorneys as an important part of the process, obviously, and there should be good defense attorneys and there should be good prosecutors, because it's an important part of keeping the system working properly. But I'm just curious as to how he has sort of become the superhero, and maybe people haven't thought about you know, how sometimes it could go the other way, you know.
Yeah, it's something I've always kind of thought about when looking at win-loss records of lawyers, because when you see someone is, you know, 100-0, just the odds of them only having innocent people come across their, you know, come through their office is just absurd, right? But I think it kind of speaks to more of the what we were talking about, of this being about the system and not necessarily cases. And, you know, just the way that Laura and Moira say, the case didn't, the state didn't do a good enough job of, you know, going against reasonable doubt or surpassing reasonable doubt, or pursuing other avenues is something that they talk about a lot. You know, not Strang, but his partner Budding says, you know, we can't kind of go down these avenues because they didn't go down these avenues in the investigation. We can't talk about evidence that they didn't care to find. We can't talk about suspects they didn't choose to talk to. Mm-hmm. Which I think is completely valid. And I think the way to kind of negotiate the idea of him being, you know, having maybe freed some guilty people is if every piece of the system, you know, the lawyers, the judges, the lawyers on both sides, the judges, you know, everyone involved in the legal system functions at their highest capacity, then the flaws in the system should make themselves apparent. Mm. So if you keep doing something that's freeing guilty people, we need to have a different system about how we determine guilt in people.
Yep.
And it's, I mean, it's something that you struggle with. I mean, imagine that there's just this, something happened. There's some inadmissible evidence that the state has that they know for sure Stephen Avery did this. And that just for some reason you can't present it in the court, but they know with 100% certainty that he did it. Mm-hmm. Then how do we think about the morality of them planting evidence to put him in jail?
Yeah.
You know, suddenly Lank might not seem as much of a bad guy if he really is putting away a murderer and perhaps preventing further murderers from taking place. And that's just some of the weird legal gray area of having this, you know, gigantic legal structure. I think it's a super tricky thing. And I think that's how Strang can still be admirable is by doing his part in a system that even if in anecdotal pieces wasn't the best thing to do, it's still the moral and right thing to do, is to create a perfect system that one day things like that won't happen.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's a good counterpoint or a good point.
Yeah. But I love listening to him talk. There's just this sincerity that, I mean, he's like a step and a half away from being a total greaseball. You know what I mean? but he just so isn't.
Yeah.
And just when he talks about justice, and I really like the one, it's a little moment, but when the judge says about Strang, you know, your lawyer has argued eloquently that blah, blah, blah. Like, it's just that one word. It's like, no, he's a great lawyer and he's a good speaker, but just in this case, he's not going to be able to pull that off. And I thought that was just a nice little moment where even the judge acknowledges, like, yeah, this guy's pretty good at what he does, but I'm not going to let this one slide.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And that's something else I wanted to bring up is just the way that, you know, these people speak, especially Strang, as I mentioned, but there's good examples throughout. The legal system, it's, you know, very structured and regimented, but in those arguments, there's kind of this place for really flowery language. And, you know, when he says swimming upstream against the presumption of innocence, like there's just this really ornamental, verbose stuff in the system designed to, you know, get to the bottom of empirical facts. And I find that juxtaposition pretty interesting. And, you know, some people say, as fate would have it that day, you know, it's like it's not legal speak, but it's lawyer speak. And I like that. And I was just wondering outside of the courtroom, how much you think that might just come from framing it. And I know you've shot things where, you know, you ask a question to someone on film, but you don't want your voice on film. So they kind of have to restate the question within their answer. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, how much that plays a part in the way that these people speak. And obviously outside of the courtroom, because they wouldn't be doing that kind of thing there, but there's plenty of non-courtroom footage and interviews.
Yeah. I mean, it's always tricky when you're interviewing somebody for any sort of video project. And certainly with the Averys, after a while, they would be very, they'd understand how they have to speak. You know, like a lot of these people are interviewed a number of times over the course of almost a decade, you know?
By the same people. Yeah, I know there's a lot of newsroom footage and things like that, but a lot of this is clearly Laura and Moira flying down to Wisconsin and interviewing them. You know, it's the same cameras. It's the same, you can just tell it's the same process.
Yeah, exactly. And so they would sort of learn how to pick it up. But I'm certain that, you know, early on in the process, there would be times when Moira's on the camera and Laura's doing the interviews, where Laura would have to be like, okay, that was great, but can you say it again, but without addressing me, really? Like, without, because you, like, generally a good trick when you're interviewing somebody is to say, instead of asking a question, say, tell me how you feel about this. And because that just gives them more, they'll tend to incorporate the actual question that you wanted to ask into their answer. And so there are just ways that you have to sort of pose questions to people to get them to actually talk how you need to talk on camera. And I feel like there were probably some times where we're looking at restated things. I'm certain that there are, you know, without knowing for sure which parts there are, but just because of the way filmmaking works. But, you know, that's generally, I don't think it's too fake, you know, that it generally people don't betray themselves or their thoughts in favor of the question or answering the question better for the filmmaker, you know.
Yeah,
just in my experience. And I don't think I also generally, like, as just a general reading of Ricciardian demos, it feels like they wouldn't be the type of people looking for that, you know.
Gotcha kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
gotcha journalism. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd asked you a question about lawyers as documentary filmmakers, and I thought it's interesting to kind of watch, you know, talk about Laura and Moira putting this documentary together in much of a similar way that the lawyers kind of have to present a story to the judge and to the jury.
Yeah.
You know, they have their bits of evidence, some that they put in, some that they leave out, and they form a narrative. And I was thinking about that, and the viewer, you know, someone watching Making a Murderer is more kind of like the defense. They don't really have to form a solid timeline or narrative as much as they just have to poke holes in the theory that's being presented, mm-hmm. you know, by the state. And just as someone who has put together some film and edited things together, with your courtroom experience, I want to know what you thought of that idea.
It's certainly not all that different. It's just kind of the materials are different, right?
And one of the things I found the most interesting about working in a courtroom is the importance that is placed on, from the lawyer specifically, on their opening and closing statements, both in how hard they prepare for them and how, like when the Crown attorney, who I was technically employee of the Crown, when he was giving his opening statements, it was, and also for the closing as well, the morning of, you know, when you're just in the office and people are getting ready to go up from court to court, there are like five Crown attorneys, but this lead guy was the guy doing the opening and closing. It was just like, no, we don't talk to Kevin today. You know, like let him be in his headspace. And it actually really felt like an athlete sort of preparing for a game where it's just like they've got their headphones on in the corner of the locker room. And I found it really fascinating. And there were a couple times when various attorneys were interrupted doing their opening and closing arguments, and the looks of rage that came over them immediately was amazing.
It seems like a big no-no.
Exactly, because it is, because yeah. Everybody knows that that's where, you know, you're writing your opening statement as how, and what you're doing is explaining what you're going to do. And then with all the evidence, you're supposed to follow through on what you said at the opening statement. And then with the closing statement, you know, it's the you're putting the button on everything. You're reminding everybody of stuff that, especially in a long trial like this, you're reminding people of the things that you brought up in evidence maybe 2 months ago, you know, and how that ties into your opening. But it's also the time when storytelling is the most, you're most allowed to actually do storytelling.
Yeah, instead of arguing.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas I think Ricciardian demos don't have as much leeway as far as writing goes for their beginning. And like, say, there is no like opening and closing argument basically of making a murderer, I don't think, because you don't have the ability to necessarily create events. Well, if you're doing documentary filmmaking properly, you don't.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's a main difference. But as far as gathering the evidence and positioning it in a way that you feel makes a cogent point, then yes, I concur. Yeah.
Yeah, and just the nature of them filming this over 10 years and the way that this story is so crazy and what makes it so good to be a documentary series like this. You know, things happen while they're filming, or, you know, the twists and turns, or new things get discovered, or new things happen. And it's harder to present that all up front, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love the dramatic shots of people furiously taking notes in the courtroom.
Oh, it's so good.
Like that is one of like the interesting, like that's a dramatic moment. It's just two guys in suits with their heads down just writing on paper. And you know, it's when you get that involved in the story, I mean, that still gets you. It still is interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's certainly an important part of being a lawyer in a courtroom, you know, like you gotta keep track of what's going on. You had mentioned to me, you had asked me a question about the fact that there's no narrator in the show. And I personally like that about it a lot. I mean, I very quickly mentioned how Sarah Koenig can annoy me on Serial. and I think it's certainly for making a murderer, I really like that there is no narrator. And I, in general, find that if you can tell a story without a narrator in a documentary, you should do it.
Or any film.
I'm sorry?
Or any film.
Well, yeah, fair enough. And I think in general, the more that you sort of present it that way, the more objective it feels, regardless of whether or not it is. It also never takes you out of the idea that this is sort of a real story. You know, it's presented more like news, so it feels more real, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. It's that level of objectivity, whether it's earned or not, is just so much more present. There's, you know, it's not, and then Sarah said this, you know, it's just text on screen. And I loved the many different ways that they were able to string a narrative through this. I mean, sometimes it does just come down to text on screen, mm-hmm. and there's no more concise way to get that across. But I feel like they went out of their way to avoid those. And I mean, the text on screen, it is kind of colder, you know, there's nothing happening, it's the silence, and it's, you know, Brandon lost his appeal or whatever, you know, and then you kind of just have the second to deal with that and kind of look at the words. And there's kind of just this cold, untouchable nature to that. Mm-hmm. But I loved, you know, just getting reporters in the hallways leaving their story on someone's voicemail, or, you know, maybe it was live or whatever, but just saying, you know, and reporting from here and, like, you know, giving you updates on the trial. I thought that was, I just don't know if I'd ever seen that before. And it really kind of, it just felt really hands-on, not exploitative, but making the most of everyone's experience in this. I thought that was a really cool way to move things along and still do it visually. And, you know, part of this is that it's a media story. And so seeing all those media scrums and seeing those people, you know, doing their job and then taking that to advance the narrative, I thought was done really well in this. And there's a couple, you know, there's a few other different examples about ways that they do that. But I thought that was a really good way to keep it going and to show everyone's experience in this, not just the victims and the accused, but the media and lawyers as well.
Yeah, for sure. Another good example of that is how they depict the deliberation process. I thought was really great.
What do you mean?
When both cases or when both trials are in, the jury's deliberating and they're just waiting for a verdict. I really enjoy the way that Ricciardi and Demos did that. You know, just in that they show people waiting around to have an opportunity to go back into the courtroom. You know, because that's what you're doing. You're on call and you're waiting for the jury to decide whether he's guilty or not. And you have to be there for when the jury comes back, you know? So I really enjoyed the way they did that. They show a group of reporters playing cards, people on the phone, and in general, like that deliberations portion takes a bit longer than I think most filmmakers would do. and it adds to the whole length thing that I enjoyed, that it sort of makes justice feel like a long process, which it is, you know?
Yeah. And just speaking on the idea of time and the theme of time, one of the things that people like about Netflix and, you know, we're talking about Serial, about podcasts and things like that, is how you get to do it on your own time. It's mm-hmm. not like traditional television and radio. It's whenever you want. If you want to watch 5 hours in a row, you can. Or if you aren't able to be somewhere in front of a TV or at a radio at a certain time, that's not a problem. And it's cool that, you know, especially Serial, Jinx, or I mean, sorry, Making a Murderer and Jinx, they kind of take these stories that span out over a decade about, you know, depending mm-hmm. on where you want to call the beginning and the ends of this, but for a lot of the activity, you know, a 10-year span, and compressing it into 10 hours or, you know, however long the runs of these shows are. And it's interesting because, you know, these stories that were happening this whole time, you know, just, you know, these trials were happening and we get Nancy Grace and things like that, but it wasn't to the level of appreciation that people have for it once these things come out. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting, these the idea that, you know, now Strang's a celebrity, Steve, not a celebrity, but, you know, a known figure, and Avery and all these people. There's always something very fascinating to me about celebrities that you didn't care about while they were doing the things that made them celebrities.
Yeah.
You know, that all of this was just kind of happening with not many people watching. Obviously, it was a known story. And it's not as though that this didn't happen before. Looking for Sugar Man and
searching, you know, for Sugar Man.
Searching for Sugar Man. And even when a lot of blues musicians got popular in the 60s, they had to go down to the American South and find them. And they were working, you know, menial jobs and things like that. Something about that delayed fame is always interesting, that you are always this person. You're always doing these things. You're always capable of something that is going to make you valuable as cultural currency, but it takes a product like this to kind of push you into the forefront.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that it's just interesting that you know, the mediums that these people are getting famous in kind of you know, speak to the way that they did get famous. And I thought that was really interesting.
Well, and you could even apply that to some of the media members who are, like, it's their job to be in front of the camera, right? So it's something that they are actively wanting, is people looking at them. But there's a couple reporters in this that I think come off extremely well, because they ask really smart, engaging questions, and it really seems like they're actively engaged. And I think even for somebody that is in front of the camera, as a profession and wants to be. It's really interesting to see them in this way, because they prove themselves to be very good in these behind the scenes stuff, you know. Like I forget her last name, but Agonette is her first name. Like she asked some really good questions at some point, and the guy that is like the quote unquote Silver Fox gentleman, he's asked a lot of really good questions over the course of the trial too, and I enjoyed that part of it a lot. And even for, you know, people that are on camera, their true fame could come later when people see that they actually are good at their job and likable, even though they were being good at their job at the time. You know?
Yeah, and they ask those questions with kind of the same interest and passion and, you know, at times incredulity that that can kind of get lost when you're doing a day-to-day job, and I imagine does sometimes. But when it's all packed together so neatly in this series, you're right. Like, it's, you did such a good job. You didn't know that this was going to be seen by this many people and it was going to be such a cultural phenomenon, but you just did your job at a time when you didn't know it would matter that much. And yeah, it shines through after all these years.
Yep. Do your job well, people.
Do your job.
Yeah, exactly. Moira and Laura will find you if you're not.
That's right. Yeah. What else do you want to talk about? There's so much here, man.
I mean, there is. Yeah. I mean, I asked you this in email. I wanted to ask on the podcast, like, so let's say a new piece of evidence shows up that allows Stephen Avery to get a new trial, right? Stephen Avery does not have money for lawyers right now. Like, yeah. I think we can confidently say that. The only reason he could afford Dean Strang and Jerry Buting was because he was wrongfully imprisoned for 18 years beforehand. So he wouldn't have money for good lawyers. So I think inevitably, if this was to happen within like the next year, year and a half, I think somebody would start a Kickstarter to fund his legal fees. And I'm curious to know how you would feel about that.
Yeah, the first thing, I could see several lawyers wanting to take it on for free.
That is also a good point, yeah.
Because just the amount of publicity he would... I mean, not his pick of the litter. I don't know how many of these very talented attorneys would offer their services for free, but he'd be able to get someone who knows their stuff to get, you know, try to put another appeal together.
Mm-hmm.
But if he, you know, if he just raised this Kickstarter campaign, it would feel unfair. And unfair is something that can apply to this story in many different ways. Mm-hmm. So I understand kind of how silly that can sound, because it's unfair that a lot of this happened to them in the first place, Brandon especially. But I mean, it would feel unfair, and it's, I mean, just when I heard about him getting, you know, a petition getting to Obama about freeing Stephen and Brandon, I mean, that's unfair too. It's unfair what happened to him, but it's unfair that because his story has these really sexy elements about, you know, police corruption and these very interesting twists and turns. Like, it's just a very good story. If this was a fictional story, it'd be a very good one. I mean,
there are parts of this story that if there was fictional, nobody would buy it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true too. Yeah. I mean, it's just that it's such a fascinating story is what made it a good documentary, and what made it a good documentary is what got so many people to see it, and what got so many and having so many people see it is what got this petition, which got all the way to Obama, mm-hmm. which, by the way, he said, this is a state case. I have nothing to do with this.
And then the governor of Wisconsin also said that he was going to do nothing about it as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's unfair in that sense, because it's just, whether you did it or not, what gives you this level of fame is because this happens to be such a wild story, mm-hmm. and it's just such a crazy case. I think that speaks to kind of another unfairness too, and that's something in victim impact statements, which, you know, the family of Teresa, in this case probably her brother, who was very present.
He's the family spokesman, basically.
Yeah, you know, he would get to say how much this crime hurt him and what it's done to his family and what a nice girl Teresa was. And I mean, those are unfair too. It's, you're more likely to sympathize with someone who is either looks like you or is attractive. So good-looking people or people of your race whether you are aware of it or not, are more likely to get your sympathy. And that's unfair too. And so there's just kind of this level of visibility shouldn't be a determining factor, or what you look like shouldn't be the determining factor. And those are things kind of either within, you know, the free market, which lets this story be told, or human nature, which lets you sympathize with, you know, people who are more like you than other people who might not speak or sound or look like you, elicit the same emotion from you. So it's unfair in the same way that I think those kinds of appeals for empathy are unfair. But at the same time, once these things are presented to you, when you see a documentary like this where something is clearly unjust, or I mean, I'll say clearly unjust, you can have your own opinion, or when you see someone who you feel bad for because something bad happened to them, and there's kind of these unconscious things working in your mind that make you feel more sorry for them than someone else, it's undeniable. You can't just say, well, you know, I saw this story, there's probably 1,000 other stories that are just as bad or worse, so I'm not going to care about this one. It's just kind of part of human nature that you want to do something. So as unfair as it is, I think it's completely reasonable and an undeniable thing to do. And I wouldn't be shocked if he got a Kickstarter campaign, and I wouldn't be upset if it worked out. I mean, if they got to the bottom of it and there was this piece of evidence that cleared everything up, obviously, what can I say? I mean, it's fantastic that you got the accurate result. So
yeah, no, exactly. And it's not like that's unprecedented as far as a documentary freeing somebody, you know. The Thin Blue Line jumping to mind, which is a movie I watched last week and which is fucking astoundingly good, and everybody should watch it. So yeah, it wouldn't be a totally new thing to happen. Yeah,
and Paradise Lost, I mean, right, I think between the second and third edition or chapters, those guys got free. And there's another, like, three of the biggest examples of these kind of docuseries about wrongfully convicted, you know, ended up having a large part in getting them free. So, I mean, it's an interesting question, but it's unfair, but it's, I think, for the best. It just sucks that some people are in jail and, you know, their story isn't cool. So it, you know, you never hear it.
Yeah. So what you're saying is I should be using my video skills to make a documentary that may or may not free somebody from prison.
Yes, yeah, please do. Okay. Yeah.
Here's the thing. I'm a capitalist, so I'm not going to do that. I don't. Our girls Laura and Moira did not make a lot of money over the last 10 years. So.
No, this is their moment now, though.
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel like we are not done with Making a Murderer by a long shot.
No, I would concur with that.
Yeah.
So, anything else you want to add?
I mean, I still have a lot more, but I think it's been an hour. I think that's good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we got to leave this shirt short enough that people are still interested, right?
That's right. Exactly.
So thanks for listening. Thanks to Winston Churchill, and thanks to Skirts. Check back next week for our next episode, which will be about 13 hours, and we'll do a little comparison to Green Zone as well, but more specifically 13 hours. Anyway, check back for that.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.